WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media
ABC
app.
News, I'm Brian Clark. Former Vice President Mike Pence told a New Hampshire television station while he has no plans to testify against former President Trump, he would respect the law if asked to testify. Former President's lawyer John Laura was asked about that possibility on ABC's This Week.
I cannot wait until I have the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Pence, because what he will do is completely eliminate any doubt that Mr. Trump, President Trump, firmly believed that the election irregularities had led to inappropriate results.
The former president's legal team's facing a Monday deadline to respond to the special counsel's request for a protective order that would limit what Trump could say about the January 6th case. U.S. women's soccer team is out of the World Cup, beaten in the round of 16 by Sweden in a penalty shootout. Teams played 120 minutes without scoring. This is the first time the U.S. has ever been knocked out before the semifinal round. This is ABC News. New details in the case of a Southern California judge who's accused of murdering his wife. ABC's Jacqueline Lee has that story.
Police say they responded to a 911 call late Thursday at the upscale Anaheim Hills home of Orange County Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Ferguson. Inside, authorities finding his 65-year-old wife shot dead and arresting him on suspicion of murder. Ferguson's neighbors in shock.
Never in a million years would imagine that, especially a judge. I mean, that's the surprising part of it all. Makes you really think about who your neighbors and everything is.
Investigators carrying rifles and guns from the home and boxes labeled ammo.
The 73-year-old was released from jail on $1 million bond. Some residents in Rankin County, Mississippi, say the activities of a rogue group of police officers who called themselves the Goon Squad went on long before some members pleaded guilty to criminal charges last week. Six pled guilty to federal crimes for the racist assault on two men earlier this year. Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dominic Crute. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show. On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin has the largest and longest-running youth apprenticeship program in America. Now, it's being recognized as one of the best. Mike Moan reports.
This summer, the Urban Institute issued a policy brief about the history and reach of the state's apprenticeship program for high school-age students. The authors say Wisconsin has adopted a well-structured, low-cost system with state support that allows for plenty of local control. The Institute's Robert Lerman helped compile the findings and says the Badger State's approach really gets to the heart of blending academics with on-the-job training.
They have part of the day or part of the week. They're at their workplace. But the whole point is that the workplace is a learning center for them.
Lerman says that's especially important for high school students worried about the cost of college. The Institute says another highlight of Wisconsin's program is that it has statewide curriculum skill standards, meaning an apprentice's credentials can be portable. Researchers say a weak spot is limitations for youth to move on to registered apprentice systems that offer extended training. Lerman suggests if more states beef up their programs as Wisconsin has,
we can improve equity and improve opportunity and efficiency and productivity for the country.
He adds his research has found that in general, U.S. apprenticeship programs lag behind many other countries in terms of their scope. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's program for youth has seen strong demand, including this past school year, with more than 5,700 employers providing apprenticeships to nearly 8,300 students. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
If you enjoy music, you don't want to miss Mile of Music in Appleton. It's underway now. I'm Todd Michaels.
And I'm Terry Barr. Mile of Music features artists playing all original tunes and all along a mile of Appleton's downtown. Todd, do you know what's really special this year? The annual festival is celebrating its 10th anniversary, and you know what? It's still free.
Yeah, the organizers like to call the Mile a cover-free zone. I like that. They also say Mile of Music has grown a lot during the past decade. There's now 700 shows and more than 40 venues, both inside and out. And Terry, I think we should pick some of our favorites.
Oh, that's not easy. But I'm going to go with a few of the area artists, like Oshkosh native singer-songwriter Christopher Gold, indie pop band 7,000 Apart. Those members are from Green Bay and Australia. Oh, one more, Appleton's Before Dawn, a light punk.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, July 29th. This is the second hour of our Saturday morning discussion about government, about law, and the aspiration for justice in America, devoting most, if not all, of our program this morning to a review of this major new superseding indictment issued against the former president and two other individuals for things that they did in connection with the management, the taking, the use, the transfer of these documents at the Mar-a-Lago facility and also at Bedminster, New Jersey. Spending a lot of time this morning talking through the indictment, what specifically alleges, and again, the indictment, as we all well know, charges returned by a grand jury that heard evidence of this information now presented in this grand jury indictment. The defendant, Donald Trump, and the other two have an opportunity, plainly, at the trial of this matter, now scheduled for May, to present their defenses to it. But significantly, when the defendant, Donald Trump, has described these things in the past, he has provided information that suggested variously that he had the right to declassify this information. Nothing wrong here, nothing at all that would suggest that he engaged in any criminal conduct. And as I was indicating in the first hour here this morning, the reason why these additional obstruction of justice counts are so very important is that they reveal a consciousness of guilt. If, in fact, you had the authority to provide all these documents, to show them around, to possess them, and you have a request from the Department of Justice, the investigators, for the production of them, the response should be, yes, I will produce them. And in fact, what we have, at least according to the allegations in this grand jury indictment, is just the opposite, an attempt to obscure, to obviate, to obstruct justice in a way that prevents that information being provided. And what does that show? It acknowledges implicitly, if not explicitly, certainly the argument to be made to the trial jury that this confirms the obstruction, and it also establishes the consciousness of guilt. You know what you're doing if, in fact, you're trying not to disclose this information to the very people who are looking at the investigative focus itself. There's more to this as well, as I indicated, and I've commented a couple of times about Bedminster as well. In the initial indictment, as we talked about it way back in June, there's a major portion beginning on page 15, other places throughout the indictment, in which the grand jury, again at that time, 26 people, account for and describe a conversation that takes place on July 21st of 2021. They note that the defendant, Donald Trump, no longer president at that time, he's giving an interview at his office, the Bedminster Club, again, not in Mar-a-Lago, but in New Jersey. He's giving this interview to a writer and a publisher in connection with a then forthcoming book, all right? So two members of the Trump staff are also there at the interview, and it was recorded. And you have probably heard from the president's own mouth a portion of this very important discussion that takes place on July 21st. None of this is new in the superseding indictment, but again, there is some information about that, about the nature of the document that's the focus of this discussion. Before the interview, the media had published reports that at the end of President Trump's term, A senior military official, we know that's Mark Milley, he was the chief of staff at the time, purportedly feared that Donald Trump might order an attack on Iran, identified as country A in the indictment. And that senior military official, again, Mark Milley, had advised Trump against doing so. That was in the public domain. All of that is the predicate for the conversation that takes place next. Again, more information in the superseding indictment that gives us more sense about why that particular conversation is so important and why, again, according to the allegations, this particular account will loom large at the trial of this matter. Upon greeting the writer, the publisher, and the two staff members, the indictment says, Trump stated, look what I found. Look what I found, he says. This was, and he's describing Mark Milley's plan of attack. Read it and just show. It's interesting, he says. And later in the interview, Trump engages in the following conversation with the writer and a staffer. He says, well, let me see that. I'll show you an example. He, meaning Mark Milley, said that I wanted to attack. Isn't that amazing? I have a big pile of papers. This thing just came up. Look, this was him. They presented me this. This is off the record, but they presented me this. This was him. This was the Defense Department. And a writer says, wow, we looked at some. This was him. This wasn't done by me. This was him. He's again responding to the Mark Milley claims in public. All of sorts of stuff, pages long. Look. And the staffer says, Trump says, wait a minute. Let's see here. There's a staffer who laughs and says, yeah, I just found, isn't that amazing? Again, looking at this document. Again, we don't know exactly what the document is at the initial time that we're reading about this transaction. Totally wins my case, you know, and the conversation goes on, except it is like highly confidential. That's the president in talking again during the course of this Bedminster conversation to people who do not have clearances. Again, the president has no capacity at that time to disclose any of this. Staffer laughs. Trump says, secret. This is secret information. Look at this. You attack, and goes on to say later, by the way, isn't that incredible? I was just thinking, because we were talking about it, and you know, he said he wanted to attack Iran, and what? He says, this was done by the military, given to me. I think we can probably write. And again, here's where the conversation, again, somewhat difficult to follow, establishes the president, the former president's understanding that the document that he's talking about is top secret, is not to be disclosed to these people who have no right to it. He says, I don't know. We'll have to see. This is the Stafford talking now. Yeah, we'll have to try to. And the former president says, declassify it. And Stafford says, figure out a way. And President Trump says, see, as president, I could have declassified it. Now I can't, you know, but this is still a secret. Now we have a problem, the staffer says. Isn't that interesting, the former president says. And again, all of that in the former indictment. The reason why this is so significant, once again, in the superseding indictment is that we now know more about what that document was in particular. The indictment, the new indictment, the superseding indictment, contains this additional charge related to this classified document that the president, the former president, is banding about in this very non-classified setting in Bedminster during the course of this conversation. It is a battle plan related to attacking Iran. And that's the document that former President Trump showed during this meeting to two people helping his former White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who are writing a book. What do we know about that document? A couple of things. It's labeled, again, it's identified in count 32, this new count in the indictment about that particular document. What do we know about that document? It's top secret. What does top secret mean? Top secret means that if it's released, if it is disclosed outside of people who have that capacity to do it, it will be exceptionally damaging to national security. That's the language. That's the reason why top secret information is not to be disclosed. That's the definition of top secret. If exposed and released, be exceptionally damaging to national security. That's the document that the former president was banding about. And it also says no foreign. What is no foreign? N-O-F-O-R-N. No foreign disclosure. No foreign communications about this. It means we don't even disclose this to our allies out there. That's how security-related it is. That's the document, a plan, again, if necessary, to attack Iran. Hugely private, hugely secret, being presented by the former president to these people who are writing a book.
indictment provides the specific dates during which Trump was in possession of that document, January 20th, 2021, the day he left office, through January 17th of 2022. That's the date that Donald Trump turned over these boxes of presidential material to the National Archives. Now, why is that important? Why do I focus on that in particular? The specificity of those dates indicates that Jack Smith, the Department of Justice, all the people looking at this have that document in question. They would not be this specific about this specific, highly, highly confidential, top secret, no foreign document in question. The indictment describes it as a presentation concerning military activity in a foreign country, noting once again its top secret. Early portions of the indictment, the superseding indictment, the indictment before it was superseded, talks about the national security implications of what the president has done. The reason why all this is significant, paragraph 3 in that superseding indictment, continuing before, talks about the unauthorized disclosure of this and other classified documents could put at risk, according to the indictment, the national security of the United States, foreign relations, the safety of the United States military, and human sources. That's human people. That's our spies, others overseas, and the continued viability of sensitive, intelligent collection materials. That I would submit to you, is why this information conveyed in this talking indictment, the superseding indictment, in which we now know more about the Bedminster event, charged now in Mar-a-Lago. Why? Why? Because plainly presented there, a part of the documents gotten by the Department of Justice, now in the possession of the Department of Justice from Mar-a-Lago, also suggests, if you read between the lines, that this no foreign top secret document traveling around America from Bedminster to South Florida, eventually again seized by the Department of Justice as a part of its investigation. All of that in the superseding indictment, now charging the former president with 40 counts along with two others for their involvement, not only in the documents, the management, the mismanagement of them, but also with conspiracy to obstruct justice, a part of the charges now going forward as a result of this investigation. We've got an additional caller online. Tom, I think you've been waiting for a while. Would be delighted to have your comments or questions as we go forward this morning.
Hi. My question is that next week, Wisconsin is going to get a new Supreme Court judge. And I'm wondering, being a new judge, will she have any say in what cases may be looked at and acted upon? Or is it up to the lead Supreme Court justice at this moment? Does that person have the power to say what's going to be looked at and what's not going to be looked at? So I'm wondering if this is going to slow things down or...
Sure, right.
I disappoint people as far as the timeline of stuff.
Right. Disappoint or in any way inspire us all to focus again on our Supreme Court. Great, great civics question. And let's finish out this segment by answering just that. You're absolutely right. August 1, Janet Protasiewicz, right now a circuit court judge in Milwaukee County, takes the oath of office. She takes that oath of office. She becomes one of our 7 Supreme Court justices, changing, if you will, the balance of the ideological split there. And right after we come back, Tom, I'm going to answer your question about how it is that the Supreme Court decides cases, both at the state level and also how our federal Supreme Court does it. It is not just at the decision of one Chief Justice or someone else. It is a vote taken by all the justices. We'll talk more about that right after this break.
Three little words no parent wants to hear.
My tummy hurts.
And it always seems to happen at the worst times. Like in the middle of the morning rush, when you still have homework to check and lunches to pack, and of course, you're already late for work. Luckily, there's Pepto-Kids. New Pepto-Kids gummies helps relieve occasional stomach upsets, turning those three words into these three words.
I feel better.
Bad time for stomach upsets? Good time for new Pepto-Kids gummies. Fast support for little tummies.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Civic Media isn't just another broadcast company.
We're your neighbors. We bleed green and gold.
And we love nothing more than to help fellow Wisconsinites succeed.
Whether your business wants to advertise to your local community or the entire state, Civic Media can help. Find out more at civicmedia.us.
She's the newest of seven elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a longtime tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Ball.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
We are back talking this morning principally about the new superseding indictment coming out of South Florida, focusing upon our former President Donald Trump and two other people also indicted along with him for document-related offenses and obstruction of justice. Right before the break, we got a good question from Tom calling in about the anticipated change here in Wisconsin. On August 1, significant things happen with our judiciary. There are judges and justices based upon recent appointments and also recent elections who are going to be taking the oath of office and taking their new positions. We've got new circuit court judges from around the state. We've got new appellate court judges. And yes, we've got a new Supreme Court justice. Her name is Janet Protasiewicz. She was right now a circuit court justice in Milwaukee County, ran for that office, as you may all recall, and was elected by the people of the state of Wisconsin to serve in that capacity for the next term, the 10-year term of office. And she will then take that oath of office on August 1. The reason I mention August 1 as being significant, it's also a time when in Milwaukee County and other large circuits, including many, many judges, lots of different assignments are made among the different kinds of cases that are handled by judges. And so all that happens on August 1. Lots of turnover, if you will, lots of movement around. And again, to ensure that justice is accomplished, rule of law promoted for in our state courts, for all the people of the state of Wisconsin. So Janet Protasiewicz takes her position on August 1 as the latest Supreme Court justice. And yes, indeed, one of the questions is what kinds of cases will they be deciding? Again, the Supreme Court, we know, the Supreme Court, we've talked about this at great length in the Department of Justice, in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. They make decisions based upon how it is they feel they should populate their docket. And so they do what's called grant writs of certiorari to parties who may be seeking review of their cases. They're very selective about the cases, usually about 60 or so out of thousands that are requested to hear. In Wisconsin, of course, the Supreme Court also has an awful lot of rulemaking authority, a lot of discretion to identify and define the kinds of things that it will also decide. But we anticipate that as these cases percolate up, including to this newly constituted Supreme Court that will take place on August 1, the Supreme Court will take on those cases that, again, either will establish some clarity in the law that defines some legal issue that has been unresolved in the state that are important to the state. And so the justices on all sides of the bench will be addressing those kinds of issues in the coming years and months as they have in the past.
significantly. The way that this happens, of course, inside the Supreme Court in the state of Wisconsin is that we'll get a change in the Chief Justice, okay? Annette Ziegler is right now the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She actually is a former colleague of mine, used to be an assistant U.S. attorney many years ago, and now Justice Ziegler. Annette Ziegler and I tried some cases together. She became a circuit court judge and then became a Wisconsin Supreme Court justice. She has been the Chief Justice recently. With the change, the ideological change, and again, changes in the ways that the court may decide cases and may decide to review cases, defining those kinds of things that it does, as appeals are taken to it from the lower courts, the new justice will almost certainly be Ann Walsh Bradley. Ann Walsh Bradley, she is a sitting Supreme Court justice. She herself is up for re-election a couple of years from now, the next major election to our Supreme Court. All of those dynamics, again, taking place as of August 1. A review by our Supreme Court, by all the seven members, again, down perhaps ideological lines, but often not. And as I've said very frequently on this program, when it comes to predicting what appellate judges do, what Supreme Court justices do, both state and federal, it is a very difficult and treacherous enterprise to do just because you don't know. Supreme Court justices often surprise us in ways that we do not anticipate, sometimes to the good, sometimes to the surprising. But we cannot predict with absolute certainty how this is going to play out. And so uncertainty is often the message coming out of our judicial analysis, both at the Supreme Court level and also the state court level. Does not mean that the Supreme Court in the coming years will not be taking and resolving some very important cases for the future of our state and the administration of the rule of law right here. So, Tom, we thank you very much for that question as appeals go up to our Wisconsin Supreme Court in the times ahead. Got another call on the line. Mark is calling in. Mark, we appreciate your time with us this morning as well.
Yeah, kind of shifted my gear on to talking about the Supreme Court, what I was going to ask this morning. But could the new majority in the Supreme Court decide to invoke a different code of ethics for our Wisconsin Supreme Court rather than one drafted by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce? Because ethical considerations are something huge in my frame of thought. And Annette Ziegler, because in her position as when she was a circuit court judge, now this is going back a long time ago now, she actually, she was actually a judge in a case that her husband was involved in, even I think a little tangentially, but still involved in that. And she did not, release that information, during the course of the trial. It was something I kind of held against her then and still hold against her now is that, because it seems to me a violation of ethics to even, entertain sin in a case that your spouse is actually involved in. So, I mean, it seems to me that the new majority of the Supreme Court say, we're going to reject the code of ethics, written by Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce, and actually impose a decent code of ethics that removes even the appearance of impropriety in cases before us, because
right.
That's.
And Mark, I think you packaged right into your question the very answer to it, which, of course, I'm not one bit surprised at. And the answer is yes. You do have a new majority, and they can set those kinds of rules. The Supreme Court has a huge amount of responsibility and authority in this area to establish rules not only for the lower courts, the appeals courts, the circuit courts, all kinds of things like that. But they can establish a new code of ethics. Again, as the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. can do, they establish all kinds of things related to bar admissions. And we know well also when it comes to lawyers being able to practice in the state of Wisconsin. Ultimately, those are decisions made by our Wisconsin Supreme Court. Hugely important who's in charge there. The decisions made, the votes made about decisions that they've got to address when it comes to cases in front of them and how it is that they themselves conduct business. Absolutely can do that. And we will look forward to that kind of activity by the court, newly constituted as of August 1. When we come back, so a few more comments about the Mar-a-Lago superseding indictment and then a couple of other important issues that percolated up out of courts in America just this past week. Stay with us for that additional commentary.
This summer. summer. 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Starting at 6 AM, the Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show.
On WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Former Vice President Mike Pence told a New Hampshire television station while he has no plans to testify against former President Trump, he would respect the law if asked to testify. Former President's lawyer John Laura was asked about that possibility on ABC's This Week.
I cannot wait until I have the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Pence, because what he will do is completely eliminate any doubt that Mr. Trump, President Trump, firmly believed that the election irregularities had led to inappropriate results.
The former president's legal team's facing a Monday deadline to respond to the special counsel's request for a protective order that would limit what Trump could say about the January 6th case. U.S. women's soccer team is out of the World Cup, beaten in the round of 16 by Sweden in a penalty shootout. Teams played 120 minutes without scoring. This is the first time the U.S. has ever been knocked out before the semifinal round. This is ABC News.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Starting at 6 AM, the Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show.
10 to 12,
As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, the Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, the Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
She's the newest of 7 elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a long-time tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr. Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Because I joined last night, and I'm hopeful.
Wow.
I'm hopeful that it is more fun than Twitter has been lately, because Twitter has not been that fun lately.
I do wish it weren't those two.
I know. It's a weird thing to be cheering for Mark Zuckerberg
right
now.
I'm choosing between the Joker and the Penguin. This is not a winning solution.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Jane Mattenair. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, yeah. StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there? I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We are back in this final half an hour or so here on Morning Cannolis, spending most of the program this morning talking about the superseding indictment, but getting some great questions also about our own justices and our courts here in the Wisconsin system, noting once again the importance of August 1 coming up just this week when we have a new Supreme Court justice going to be sworn in, and the process by which our Supreme Court here in the state of Wisconsin, much like the federal Supreme Court, takes cases. So again, as a good caller, Thomas, indicating a lot of process there. If you're unsuccessful, unhappy with a court of appeals decision, and want to pursue that to the Supreme Court, Three justices of our Supreme Court have got a vote on that. The process is called reviewing a petition for review. And the Supreme Court gets about 800 of those requests every single year. But three justices, I have to decide, yes, indeed, among that 800 or so, that this is a case when a pick and choose, much like our United States Supreme Court does, same kind of process, usually chooses about 65, maybe 70 cases every year. Again, paralleling very closely the docket, the kind of thing that our federal Supreme Court does. This process, again, part of the rule of law, beginning with a trial court, pursued in an appellate court, and ultimately, if in fact the Supreme Courts, federal and state, determine that this is a matter that should be addressed by them, getting further review there and getting decisions by our highest courts in the land. Great questions about the process here as we talk, as we do every Saturday morning about civics. Got also a significant comment, really a question from Gene in our text. We also appreciate tremendously not only the callers, but also those who are texting. And she said this, is a grand jury a safeguard? A terrific question, because it goes once again to what a grand jury is, what it does. And the answer, Gene, is absolutely it's a safeguard. It is in the federal constitution. The reality is that the U.S. Department of Justice, U.S. attorneys, special counsels, assistant U.S. attorneys cannot bring charges. There's a process for putting a criminal complaint in place initially. But ultimately, charges have to be decided, if at all, by a grand jury. And what is the reason for that? What is the reason why James Madison put that into our Constitution? You've got a right to indictment, if at all, by members of the grand jury, grand jurors of your peers, if you will. They are the public. They're the ones who say whether or not the government has presented in that setting sufficient evidence to find by probable cause that indeed, there's a reason to charge. And again, as I indicated, in my own experience, this grand jury, these grand juries out there do their jobs seriously. And I suspect if you've got grand jurors who self-identify in your own situations, if you come across them, they will tell you about the important work that they do in questioning witnesses, in reviewing documents, and determining whether or not there is probable cause. It is a safeguard against prosecutors who may seek indictments that are inappropriate, that where the evidence isn't there. This is absolutely the guide rail to ensure that our system has integrity to it. And then, of course, the additional part of this is that even after they made that finding of probable cause, that safeguard, this initial step for charging, that is not to say that the defendant is guilty. That's only done by a second jury. That's the Pettit jury, the trial jury, also convened this time in public from among what? The public, the community. And the community then takes a look at the evidence in open court most often and determines whether there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, highest standard possible, before we convict somebody in our state and our federal courts of a federal or a state offense. That's the process. That's the safeguard at all steps along the way. Of course, the adversarial system generally related to how this works, the back and forth between prosecutors and defense attorneys, which not only we embrace, but also exalt as one of the touchstones of our system. Great question, great observation. A safeguard, absolutely one of many all along the way to ensure that justice is done and that we do not convict people absent this high level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt at trials. Thank you so much for the observation, Gene, on text. And Joe, also calling this morning, appreciate your involvement in our discussion this morning.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this timeline and the specificity of the details and the conversations that were had. My question is this. You were speaking of the document that Trump was waving around in New Jersey, and this was in front of a writer who was doing an interview with him and two staffers that I believe were associated with Mark Meadows, correct?
Right.
They were staffers. Okay. So we have a total of three people, actually four, who should not have any access to this piece of paper that delineates the war plans to in a possible battle with Iran, correct?
Yes, right? Exactly.
I mean, all
that's
four
the concern.
Should
yes.
not have access to it.
Right.
Yeah, at this point, because that is why ex-President Trump said, yeah, this doc is top secret. We'll have to declassify it. Now I can't. Now we have a problem. Isn't that interesting? Which to me is sort of the understatement of all time.
Yes, right.
The question I would have for you, Do you suppose, as a prosecutor, when you look at this, my understanding is that there are boxes and boxes of documents that they can't find. There's stuff that they have found. They don't know where it's been. Basically, this one document that they're speaking of that makes up this charge, this document about the battle plans for Iran is now, it's dead. They can't use this battle plan for Iran anymore because we now have three people and four, if you include the president, who have had access to this. And you spoke of it, and I thought it was an interesting way of describing it. You said, this is not just a top secret document. It is described as no-4, which is meaning no foreign, anybody from a foreign entity cannot be looking at this either. So extremely valuable, extremely important. So when they say that this could be very, very deleterious to our national security, at this point, this is all blown. You're not going to use this battle plan anymore because you have no assurance of it being top secret anymore, right? It's dead in the water. So do you suppose, as a prosecutor, Jim, that part of the reason why Smith may have looked at this particular case is the seriousness of it, but also the fact that this, as you said, that this document has been traveling from Florida yes. up to New Jersey, you know, it's absolutely bare, if you will. It doesn't have any protections at all. So is part of it, do you think, that he's trying to show the seriousness, but isn't it all, would it also matter as a prosecutor that you're trying to show a tie to Bedminster? He's now in Bedminster with these documents. And would this give him an extra oomph to, do you think that there have been any secret searches of Bedminster because of this? Do you think there's anything that's gone on in the same? Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Has there been work in Bedminster? Yeah. Okay. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Absolutely.
So
again, wonderful thoughts about this. And Joe, you could be one of these investigative people, one of the prosecutors out there, because those are exactly the kinds of questions that you ask. You have to believe, again, part of this is speculation with a small f, but have to believe that Jack Smith, all of his attorneys on his staff as well, they're asking exactly those kinds of questions. They've been asking about them for a long period of time, long before we even knew about all these Bedminster conversations and the document itself. They've been looking at this kind of thing. The question, of course, is always number one. What happened there? And obviously they've got not only the recording, we've heard that. You can go online. The media is playing this routinely. It's from the president's own voice. But beyond that, Jack Smith is asking, again, who are these people? What is their involvement in this? And beyond that, what more is out there, which is, I think, the focus of your question. The question always about whether or not to go back into Bedminster is this. Is there, once again, probable cause, the same standard for a search warrant? Is there probable cause to believe that at this moment, or very close to it, there is reason to believe, probable cause, that there's evidence of a crime in that location? You have to believe that Jack Smith and his folks have been asking this question all along. It's got to be premised upon individuals who say, you know what, I was there, I saw this, I heard this, I was present to provide this information to you. It's got to be current, it's got to be recent. A magistrate judge, a federal judge, is not going to look at me or other prosecutors and say, well, this was there 6 months ago, especially with documents that obviously tend to move, especially in this case, around a lot. It's got to be recent. It's got to be current. And then you also look at the credibility of the people you're talking to. And in this case, I had to hearken back also to Mar-a-Lago. We know that the affidavit in support of the search warrant that came out sometime after the August event there, a huge number of pages there, more than 30 pages, much of that redacted. Remember this when we talked about this? An awful lot of indication, yes, of obstruction there, but an awful lot of indication as well that you had people on the ground, probably including the very people we're now talking about, including the IT specialist, employees number 4 and 3 and 5 there. An awful lot of people describing what they saw at Mar-a-Lago, explaining how these boxes were moving around, explaining probably from close to the start how the video cameras worked. All of that would be the subject of questions by any good prosecutor, including Jack Smith, as he's reviewing all of this information. All of that, you have to believe, asks not only about the Mar-a-Lago circumstance, that venue there, but also, Joe, to your good point, about Bedminster. And let's make it even broader. Other places, I'm sure there are questions being asked about the other places where Donald Trump has had business. Trump Tower in New York City, of course, comes to mind. Other places, even overseas, great concerns there and issues related to executing warrants beyond the scope of our borders. But all of that,
prosecutors look at the kinds of things that would normally happen with documents. Where do you get information from? Those questions are asked not only by prosecutors, but yes, also getting back to the central point of this discussion this morning, also by grand jurors who want to know not only about the things in front of them. I can't tell you how many times a grand jury is asking me and asking investigators appearing in front of them, what else is out there? What else do we need to know? What else have you done? That kind of thing. That's good investigation. Now, it does not always mean that you're going to produce information. You're going to produce information that supports a finding of probable cause that someone has committed a crime, but you explore it out of good professional investigative work. You do that kind of thing to ensure that if indeed there's no crime out there, that no crime is charged. But if there is some criminal activity, likewise, you pursued it to the point that you can. You've done search warrants. You've made requests, grand jury subpoenas to get documents from those locations. That's a part of a central part of not only, obviously, the entire investigation here, but focusing again, the superseding indictment. It was as a result of requests for documents, even before the search warrant in Mar-a-Lago took place, when those agents were there, that they looked around and said, gosh, look at those cameras. Huh. I wonder what else we might get from those cameras. And then they go back and make the similar request. In that case, a grand jury subpoena for that information. Joe, a great question. Again, as you normally, in your common sense pursuit of these kinds of things, in your own life, when you think about how do I find out information, you ask those questions. Prosecutors do exactly the same kind of thing. Some final comments here before we go into a break about all this. And then, as I said, some additional commentary about other courts out there, significant things that we're going to simply mention today and then talk about in a future broadcast. And then there's two other things that come out of the superseding indictment. One of them, again, is about obstruction of justice. An awful lot of people looking at this and saying, we've seen this kind of thing before, again, alleged conduct to be proven at a trial. We know from the Mueller report from way back in April of 2019, that Bob Mueller investigating the connection between the 2016 campaign and Russia. This report raised not just some questions, but made some very specific findings, 6, 8, 10 different instances in which Donald Trump, in connection with the investigation of Russia, may have also obstructed justice. And, of course, among those, of course, his request to his very attorney at that time to produce a document that was false and incomplete, Don McGahn, creating a fake document, rebutting statements that he gave to Mr. Mueller's office at that time. McGahn refusing to do that, even though Trump wanted him to do that, an obstruction of justice event. That has happened before, and we've seen this once again in this superseding indictment. All of those things back in the Mueller investigation have tendrils, the same kind of conduct, stopping investigations, firing the person, attempting to fire the person, and firing the person who's investigating the case, looking at all of that. We know significantly that John Bolton, the White House former national security advisor, the third one there in the White House at the time, in his own memoir, talked about Mr. Trump's approach to all these things. And he said, this is obstruction as a way of life. That's John Bolton's description of all of this. We see more of this again today in the superseding indictment. We've seen it before in response to this kind of investigative work. When we come back, again, some additional commentary and then a couple of other comments about what's going on in our federal courts just this past week.
So hot. Wait. Now it's going to rain? It is summer in Wisconsin.
As much as we love it, we love to hate it too. Find a forecast you can count on along with the in-depth details you need only from the Civic Media Weather Team.
These extended conditions have led us into a flash drought. Sitting in these above average temperatures with minimal rain has swiftly altered the local climate.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., the Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, the Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, the Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
She's the newest of 7 elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a longtime tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr. Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
We're back, and some final commentary about what the meaning of the superseding indictment is all about right before the break, talking about the significance of obstruction. Things we have seen before from the former president, greatly troubling in terms of the administration of justice. Another thing that comes out loudly and clearly from the superseding indictment is this focus on loyalty. Focus on loyalty. And again, we hearken back to the time of the Mueller investigation. And that time, you may recall well, that there were requests by the former president about loyalty from the people around him. Very notoriously, very early on in his presidency, the president at that time, Donald Trump, asked the former FBI director, at that time he was the director, James Comey, for his loyalty. He asked for his loyalty, and Mr. Comey was sort of surprised by that, continued pursuit an investigation into ties between Donald Trump's campaign and Russia, and as a result of what Donald Trump viewed as a breach of loyalty to him, the director of the FBI was fired. James Comey was fired. Mr. Mueller then takes up the investigation as special counsel following that as well. A huge amount of focus on loyalty. During the course of his presidency, several of the allies and associates, Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, indicted by the Justice Department in cases that could have produced some very damaging testimony about former president and his campaign. As the prosecutions of those folks went forward, Donald Trump publicly dangled the idea of issuing pardons. And in the final weeks of his presidency, he did, in fact, pardon them. Again, focusing on this notion of loyalty to me. And if, in fact, you do that, I will reward you with that. We've got more of that even in the document that was presented to the public as a result of this grand jury indictment just this past week. In particular, what we know is that a couple of days after all of this is happening, there's a question made about whether or not Carlos de Oliveira is quoted as saying, someone just wants to make sure Carlos is good. That's in the indictment. Whether he is loyal, whether he'd be loyal to the president. Nauda is quoted as saying that about Mr. de Oliveira to another Trump employee. And that employee told Mr. Nauda that de Oliveira was loyal and would not do anything to affect his relationship with Donald Trump. That focus once again upon this notion of loyalty to Donald Trump, not loyalty to the nation, loyalty to justice, loyalty to what is right, but to Donald Trump himself. Significantly, shortly after that exchange, Donald Trump called Mr. de Oliveira, said that he would get him a lawyer. That, again, according to the superseding indictment, legal fees for de Oliveira, for Nauta, and other Trump employees who become witnesses or defendants in this document case are being paid by a political action committee affiliated with Donald Trump. That loyalty concept, again, combined with this obstruction of justice concept, coming out loudly and clearly from this superseding indictment. A couple of other points before we begin to conclude today, and that is program notes about our discussion next week.
I'm going to talk next week about two of the things that federal courts do. Chatted earlier about Eileen Cannon in South Florida administering, supervising this case involving the documents. We also know that just this past week, a judge in the U.S. District Court in Northern California, his name is John Tiger, struck down on Tuesday the stringent new asylum policy that the Biden administration has called as part of its attempt to curb illegal crossings and immigration issue. I'm going to spend some time parsing through that and understanding exactly what the judge did there in that case and determining whether or not, in his determination, whether that policy is consistent with the law and the Constitution. Very significant, very interesting discussion and presentation by that judge, finding, at least for now, stayed his order for a couple of weeks, that that particular Biden administration policy cannot stand. Another judge, this one in Maryland, her name is Mary Ellen Norica, the Federal District Court in Wilmington, decided this past week not to accept, or at least to put on hold, her final confirmation of the Hunter Biden plea deal. Again, you recall well, was going to plead guilty to two tax misdemeanor counts and averted prosecution on a gun charge. She decided, again, based upon her analysis, that proceeding should not go ahead. The decision not yet finally been made, but very interesting analysis that she undertakes there. Some good examinations, just like the judge in Northern California of the asylum policy. Some very good things that she talks about in connections with what a plea agreement is all about, the understandings of what a judge does, what prosecutors and defense attorneys should be doing. Lots of things we've talked about also today in connection with this superseding indictment. Join us next week for that all-important discussion about those important roles that federal district court judges play in examining and determining not only the work of the executive branch when it comes to policies and practices in the case of the immigration matter coming out of the Department of Homeland Security, but also overseeing the work of prosecutors deciding in this particular case, at least not for now, not to, as the judge said, not to rubber stamp what the prosecution and the defense have presented as a closed deal, and basically putting this off until they can come and address some greater concerns that she has that go to the Constitution and other things related to the administration of justice. Very, very important things we're going to talk about at the top of the hour next week as we discuss these things further. And as we begin to close this morning, I want to also indicate that as a part of the Civic Pints initiative here through Civic Media, we've actually extended the initiative well into August, throughout the month of August, to ensure that all of us who may want to participate in this good and important community effort have the opportunity to do so. Once again, this initiative, Civic Pints, go and give blood to your local hospital, your clinic, someplace else. And if you give us some information, some confirmation, a selfie, some other evidence, and give it to us through the URL, through some mechanism here, through Civic Media. Now, because of the way in which the Civic Media leadership and management is handling the program, you're almost certain not only to be entered into the prospect of winning, but you almost certainly will be a winner. You will be a winner of either Brewer tickets or also State Fair tickets, also coming up very soon right here in the greater Milwaukee area, and also some Civic Media merchandise. Again, extended through the month of August into the coming month, and almost can guarantee, Anya and I can almost guarantee that if you go and do this wonderful thing on behalf of the community and our community health generally, you will receive Brewers tickets, State Fair tickets, or otherwise also through the Civic Media auspices. You can just go to Civic Media identify that civicmedia.us/giveblood, and you'll find right there all the information you need to know to make that happen. A very important thing, again, to keep us all healthy as we go forward in this summer months, not only here in Wisconsin, but throughout our nation. I've enjoyed, again, speaking with you. Always appreciate the callers calling in to talk about these all-important issues here, calling in about grand juries, about trial juries, about the roles that courts play, Supreme Courts, trial courts, appellate courts. All of that is a part of our discussion here on Morning Cannolis. That will continue not only in the weeks ahead, but the months ahead as well, as we continue to work with you in talking about these all-important issues that affect our democracy in 2023 and beyond. Thank you, everybody, for being a part of our enterprise here. Have a great week. We'll talk with you and engage with you again next week, Saturday. Oh, you're a rich girl, and you're going too far, 'cause you know it.
If you care about animals or crops, you probably care how the weather could impact both.
It's summer in Wisconsin, and the success of your efforts often depends on knowing the forecast. Count on your local Civic Media weather team for all the information you need.
Crops' roots are also growing deeper in search for water, which is bad news, because when rain finally falls, it will sit shallow and be absorbed in the top layers of the soil.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the app.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7,
The... You're listening to The Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News.